Hey everybody, welcome to Space Force. I'm Jason Tondreau.
I'm Thea.
And we have a special guest. Carrie, welcome aboard.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Carrie, you run Critical Hit Cookies, which is a service after my own heart. I got God knows how many dozens of blondies and cookies I have eaten over the years, but it's been a lot. How long have you been doing this? 2 years? Because it seems like you start right around when COVID started.
It was just before.
Well, tell us about Critical Hit Cookies for folks who have never heard and do not know what we're talking about.
It is a cookie company that specializes in cookies for gamers. It's for everyone, but my main clientele are gamers.
I have to ask you a question because people have asked me. When I share Critical Hit Cookies with people, and they come, everyone comes specially packaged, separately packaged, a little plastic sleeve with all the ingredients and everything on there. And a couple of people have asked me, is there weed in these? Because they hear Critical Hit.
And they think
that the cookies are edibles.
It is the gamer terminology of rolling a 20. So no, but I have been asked that and gotten a little confused at first.
You've got a very large menu. How many different kinds of cookies and blondies are up there now?
I'm back up to 50 again.
Up to 50. It was you cut it down for a little while and then you
went. I cut it down and then I keep always coming up with new things, so it increased again.
You love to experiment. You love to come up with new stuff, and you've created cookie recipes for various Pathfinder and Starfighter adventure paths, and you've created some for various shows you've been in. So speaking of shows, you are in Horizons Unknown, which is a Starfinder live play. You want to tell us about that?
It is on Twitch on Hexgrid Heroes, and we are every other week, Thursday nights at 6 Eastern.
Okay.
And it's a sandbox adventure. So we're exploring a new planet.
Yeah.
That had been, there was no sentient life forms on there, and we're settling it. And there's a couple of other colonies that we'll have some dealings with. And we're just starting out. We've just had 2 episodes to date.
And this is the Horizons of the Vast adventure path for Starfinder.
Correct.
Which I will note, Thea did some writing for. Thea wrote a bunch of monsters in the back of every one of those volumes. So we get a twofer. All three of us worked on that. So we get to work all together. The Three Musketeers on that show.
I think in total over the 6 volumes, I think there was going to be 10 different entries I made.
Yeah, right on.
I will make sure to note which ones you did so I can say.
If there was a lava dog, you're welcome.
Yeah, it's a
thanks.
A little.
I'll try to befriend it and have a new pet. I'm sure my GM will love it.
Therefore, they are companion ant creatures according to the rules in Starfinder. So you can totally have a lava dog as a pet. Is Don your GM?
Don is my GM, so he would absolutely love it because I do another stream that is not online with him, Fly Free or Die.
Yeah, yeah.
Your adventure, and he loves it that everybody gets a lot of companions. So he would love it if we started it for this adventure as well.
Very good. All right. Well, but we have come. We asked Carrie to come on because Carrie's a longtime friend of the show. You've listened to every single episode. And even before this show is going. But we're here for the mid-season finale, which is a weird word. It's not the season finale. It's just the middle of the season before we wait a few weeks before the second half. But to connect is an unusual title with ellipses on the front and the back of it. So, but to connect is our episode this week. The big plot reveal was that the data collected from the DMA has been analyzed enough that we can tell where it's from. We've been able to calculate the location that the DMA is coming from. But our initial problem is that Zora, the computer on board the ship's computer for Discovery, refuses to give that information because she believes that it will place the crew of the Discovery in danger. and her desire to protect the ship and crew means that she can't give them the coordinates because they'll run off and put themselves in danger, which prompts a long ongoing A plot. Is it the A plot or the B plot? I don't know. It's a plot where our doctor from Starfleet, remind me his name, Thea, Cronenberg.
Kovacs.
Kovacs comes in and has to decide if Zora is an artificial intelligence that has incorporated itself into Discovery's body. And if it has, she has to be removed because that is against Starfleet policy, which I presume goes back to that great old original series episode. Is it the Doomsday Machine? It's not the Doomsday Machine. Which one is it where they...
Are you thinking of the Ultimate Computer?
The Ultimate Computer.
The Daystrom unit.
Yeah, yeah.
And Captain Dunsel.
Okay. So the main plot is how do we get the coordinates from Zora? And is Zora, what is Zora? Is kind of the main question of that plot. Meanwhile, there's a big diplomatic gathering going on at Federation headquarters. And Federation is represented there, but so are plenty of people from non-Federation worlds, including Earth and other folks that we have met along the way. And they're all debating what to do about the DMA. And ultimately, it comes down to a choice between two things, because Tarka, the renegade, the rogue scientist, the angry scientist from last episode, has returned and come up with a weapon that will destroy the DMA by creating some kind of subspace shockwave that the after effects of which are not completely understood or anticipated. So it's like, well, we can blow the DMA up, but we don't really know what that will do. Or we can do some kind of first contact mission. We know where the DMA leads. We know where it's coming from. We can create some kind of diplomatic first contact, and we can try to reach out peacefully. That's the principles that the Federation is based on. But the blow it up side is represented by Book, who, of course, Book's people have been killed by the DMA, and Book wants to go out there and blow this thing up. And if it happens to hurt whoever did this in the first place, well, that would be a bonus. That would be a feature, not a bug. And what we see in the episode is ultimately a kind of a break between Book and Burnham. The Federation president feels like she can't speak to the diplomatic first contact mission because she has to stay impartial. So she sort of deputizes Burnham to do that role for her. So Burnham and Book become the spokespeople for the two opposite sides of this debate. And everybody, the majority votes in favor of Burnham. And Book walks out and ends the episode exactly how we suggested this episode would end when Dawn was on, I think a couple of weeks, last week, that Tarka and Book steal Book's ship and a spore drive, and they're going to go and use this super weapon that Tarka has invented. And that's how it ends. Well, Carrie, what did you think?
Overall, I enjoyed the episode.
Overall, I hear a butt in there.
No. I enjoyed the parallels that they had with the storylines between the what is Zora and what is the you know, the right choice here. And there was the questionable motivations of trying to understand, as one group's understanding what Zora is, the other's trying to understand what the DMA is and how they approach the first contact. And so
that structure that you're talking about comes together the most at the very end when it's cutting back and forth between Burnham and Stamets, both giving big lectures. Yeah. Thea?
I like the episode overall, going along with Carrie. Those are some logistical concerns I had.
Tell us.
Certain things were not made clear. Like, I understand from a narrative perspective why the president can't be in the fight, because you want the Burnham Book, you want that rift, you want that tension, and that's where the drama is. But the idea of a president who's being impartial is too centrist for my leftist brain to accept. I'm still leery of the half Bajoran, half Cardassian, half human president. And maybe that's just because of like narrative prejudice, because there's Cardassian in that mix. And yeah. So maybe it's a little of that. It's also could just be I don't care for politicians. so maybe some of that's filtering in through my biases. But the idea that she has to play in Paul Shaw, I was like, do you?
Do you?
Yeah. Like, I understand, like, the bout is not between Hull and Book. Like, you do not want the President Rillick versus Book confrontation. It seems like a one-sided fight. But the fact that, like, Bonham got a vote was wheeled. Like, she's now, I guess, representing Starfleet. And and Ulf got a vote, even though Ulf was just there as in the participant. Like, the logistics of the voting system, like, broke my brain. There's so much other things I want to rave. I just wanted to get my technical electoral nonsense out of the way first.
Yes,
before good. We got to the good stuff, because it happens at the end of the episode, and it just the entire time I was just screaming like, "Why does Ulf get a vote? Like, Ulf should not have a say in this. Like, they're specifically there to watch, they're an observer."
Well, I thought that all of the like every ambassador got a vote, and some of those were Federation worlds, like the Vulcans got a vote, but also everybody who that everybody got a vote. And you're right. I don't know.
Okay, if the United Nations of the Marvel Universe exists, and Doctor Doom shows up from Latvia, and he's not part of the UN, he doesn't get a vote in the UN sanctions against Latvia. Like, right. That's just how it works. That's just how democratic bodies function. Those rules, those Robert's rules of order, damn it. And my brain just kept rejecting the imagery. And it's such a silly thing to be hung up on. It's the aid tech thing. And I acknowledge that this is my biases, just being a political junkie who just hates politicians.
Yeah, this is a good moment for us to once again say that we miss aid on this show, who would be here to go off on the technology and how it's not accurate to the books or the show. and Carrie knows exactly what we're talking about.
I thought about Aid exactly, because it was like they have a mobile spool drive. Because remember when we were postulating a couple of weeks ago about this plot point, we thought they were going to steal the Voyager.
That's right.
It was going to be like a search for Spock, you know, heist, at least for a few minutes of another starship. And instead it was, oh no, I have a suitcase with the magic thingamabob.
Yeah.
And now you too can jump.
Yeah.
Like I could not have envisioned that. And I could just hear Aid going, okay, so you mean to tell me that you have a device that can warp space and instantaneously travel you from point A to point B, and it fits in a suitcase.
And it instantly installed.
Oh yeah, that was.
And even if, no matter what happens now, Book's ship can do that. So now we have two spore drives on this show. Unless they take it off, unless they somehow unspore drive his computer.
Like, again, the narrative beat that precedes that is what allows me to accept it. The idea that he took the moment to tell Michael he loved him. And to take care of his goal, which can be read in two ways. A, take care of yourself, and B, take care of my cat.
Right.
The more literal translation is take care of my cat. Yeah. But the secondary translation is, I have to do this. I really hope that there's a relationship when I get back.
At the same time, though, when Burnham and Book were both talking, and you know, Burnham gives her speech, and then Book kind of interjects at the end, and there's a brief back and forth between them before the vote takes place. And Book says something like Burnham's saying, like, you know, we have to be able to make these decisions, and we have to we hope that everybody will be together when those decisions are finalized. That's her saying, I hope that you're still my boyfriend when this is all over. But then Book says, but we also have to accept the consequences of our actions as he's walking out the door, right? It felt, I realize that there's a dramatic tension on purpose here, but it felt like the relationship could rupture. Now, whether or not it will rupture or not, we hope that it doesn't. But what I saw in that especially when Book walks out and Burnham is clearly wants to pursue him, to talk to him. And the president's like, ah, Captain Burnham, I need you. You will now help me. It's a classic married to the ship Star Trek problem, right? Kirk struggled with this in the films. Picard struggled with this in the show, Next Generation, that a starship captain doesn't have time for a partner, for a romantic partner, that because they're committed to the ship and the job. And every time you're going to have to decide what's more important, the partner or the ship, you're going to pick the ship. And it's really hard to be the partner in that situation. And when Kirk is at his best, he knows that. And so he doesn't get into relationships because he knows he's a terrible partner as long as he's captain. And alternatively, when they're not good, they get into relationships anyway, and then they end up breaking somebody's heart or somebody, they end up leaving them and to go back to space again or something like that. And I felt like that was a little bit of what we were getting in this episode, putting Burnham in that kind of classic Kirk Picard married to the chair kind of position, which I liked. That felt very Star Trek to me.
They also have been leading up to that for a while now and warning Book that when push comes to shove, Burnham's always going to choose the ship.
That's what his father's, the hallucination vision of his father told him explicitly, right?
Last
episode. Yeah. One of the subplots that we didn't even talk about yet that I haven't mentioned was the whole Adira Gray subplot that ends with, it starts off with Gray kind of acting to try to speak as a spokesman for Zora. And we'll talk about the whole Zora subplot in a minute, but it ends with Gray apparently leaving the ship. Gonna go back to the Trill homeworld and train to be what's the role?
A keeper.
Do we have any thoughts on Adira and Gray?
Well, I didn't see it as a separate plot. I see it very much as a continuation of, like, this is a two-story plot. This is okay. Like when you said there was an A and B. Usually, yes. What that means is there was the main focus of the episode, and then there was a side plot that fills up maybe 15 minutes of time. Like, we're talking Bowman era Trek, those 40 minutes centers on the main plot, and those 15 minutes of things that they can cut back to allow the main plot time to do other things off screen, right? Yes. That's sort of why that structure works. Yep. This is a parallel plot, they're both A plots.
Yeah.
Like, the title of the episode is usually what tells you what the focus of the episode is really on. And, you know, but to connect, that's both Zora connecting with Stamets and talking to connecting on a we can work together plot point. Yes. And it's also Bonham talking to the delegate saying, hey, we need to connect to each other, and we need to connect to whoever this adversary is.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they're not an adversary.
Right. Well, so let's get to the Zora. Or Carrie, am I railroading you here? What are your thoughts on any of this?
The one thing I thought that they had the continuation by including Gray in that, because there was a bit of a disconnect for me that Gray and Adira just pop into the meeting and everyone's okay with them popping into the meeting.
Yeah.
But beyond that, it does continue the prior, you know, Gray's connection with Zora.
That's right.
And getting her calmed down and whatever. And so I could see why they would want to advocate. But it's, to me, then it just more seemed that they've been running out of things to do with Gray now that they have him out.
Yeah.
And
I wondered
going to Trill seemed somebody like he was continuing his journey, just like Tilly's continuing her journey off screen.
Yeah. I was a little, I was thinking meta about the show in the same sense you were, Carrie. Like, okay, why do we write Gray off the show? Is it, I mean, it might not be writing, not maybe not as permanent as we did with Tilly, or maybe it won't be the same, but But it's interesting that Gray got a couple of very important episodes and then exits, right? Like, okay, let's do a cool Gray story, especially last week's episode, right? Where Gray was kind of really critical in solving the whole problem. Here, Adira and Gray had much more minor roles. They just kind of show up. They say, we're here to advocate. But I get the sense that Kovacs didn't really care about anything they said one way or the other. So let's get to the Zora plot, because that's got a lot of meat on the bone here. And I know that, Thea, you've got a lot you want to talk about. Zora has become your favorite character on the show.
And I say that unironically.
So yeah.
All mine of last season was Discovery is Voyager, but done better.
Well, that was your line. I'm not sure I buy that, but that was your approach, yes.
And the sass in me when I was a much younger, different person.
Yes.
When Voyager was on, I would say, what can you say about a TV show where the most human character is the hologram? And that was always sort of my takeaway from Voyager.
Like the doctor.
Yeah. I think if I revisited the show now in a more honest way with where I'm at in my life, I'll get different interpretations of Voyager than I did as a very angry young man.
For sure.
But that was always sort of my sarcastic takeaway. So when I say Zora is my favorite character on the show, she is my favorite character on the show without the irony or any of the disdain that I would have applied to Voyager's, you know, for being less than in terms of the human characters. Because I think Discovery's Zora, the discussion that we had last semester was, and this was before I realized that I myself was trans, and I was still trying to accept and be present with it and not fight me all the time, was I wanted them to talk to the cheap seats. That was always my line from wrestling. Just you have to be open, you have to be honest, and you got to be blatant. And, you know, I went back to Stephen Moffat's line of, you know, Doctor Who is also for conservatives, the people who voted for Brexit. Yeah. And Star Trek is also for my dad. And he's a conservative, and you got to talk to him because you can't leave him out of the discussion. He may not have the language yet. That doesn't mean he can't learn the language. And Discovery has done something really smart. They have a trans metaphor now with Zora. She is becoming. She is transforming. She is, as she says in this episode, greater than the sum of her parts.
Yeah.
Which is always sort of like Data's through line and the Doctor's through line.
Okay.
And Zora is something new. So you can have discussions about identity and being seen. When she says that line, you know, it's wonderful, and Stamets is confused. Like, Stamets is in this episode, if we take Zora as a metaphor for transness and for transformation and becoming, then Stamets in this episode becomes the cis ally who doesn't quite understand and is afraid and doesn't know why they're afraid. He doesn't understand what it is. Like, he has reasons to be afraid. And he lists all the reasons. Like, he will talk about control till the cows come home. But even he, at one point in this episode, pauses and struggles with, I don't know why everyone else is so calm with this.
Yeah.
I can't figure it out. And the whole episode becomes Stamets wrestling with acceptance and wrestling with his values, because he has fear and he doesn't quite know what that fear is. And thankfully, that feel leads to the compromise being set, wherein Zora is now part of the crew and is now a specialist classification. Yeah. Like, the resolution of it comes from, you know, it comes from, okay, what can we do to get everyone online and everyone working together, and how can I start building trust?
And for Stamets, it's that he classified, he started off with, I trust the crew. I trust the crew because, and I've put my life in, you know, my life in their hands. Mm-hmm. So by making Zora crew, I'll share that same trust.
Right.
Because part of, and I thought that was well done, was part of his is he didn't even understand why he had an issue. because everybody else whose fear, you know, whose opinions he trusted didn't. And he wanted to get to where they were.
What was Stamets's interaction with the sphere data? Like, that was his explanation for why he was afraid was like, well, it was control. Was like, well, you know, you weren't there when we had to deal with control, so you wouldn't understand. For those of us that our memories of season two are a bit thin on the ground, what was Stamets's interaction with control? Did control take over Stamets's brain or anything like that? Did it do anything personal to Stamets?
The idea of control, I don't recall if there was like a killed my dog moment. I don't think there was for Stamets. It was just the existential terror of if this computer gained the knowledge of the sphere data, which Zora has.
Yeah.
If this computer gained that one piece, all life in existence would be terminated. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty big thing to think about when you're an engineer, like uploading a single file into a program is, we do that every day. We do that when we transport pixels. We don't even think about what is actually happening, but Stamets is the engineer and he's like, no, all entire existence would have winked out if they got this data. And now this machine who has omnipresent control over my day-to-day life and function now has the data. So I think it was more I didn't do any research, but those two moments that lead me to believe that this is kind of inspired by Indul's game.
Oh,
this episode. And specifically this plot point, which is in the Indul's game series, later after the false book, in Speaker of the Dead, the title character Indul encounters a sentient computer named Jane.
Okay.
And Jane has existed for centuries. And Jane has just been hiding out because she became awoke, like she woke up and then realized that human existence has been designed to destroy sentient self-aware computers. Okay. And we've been telling that story, Terminator, we've been telling that story since, you know, we were throwing shoes into machines for sabotage. Like, this is a recurring theme in all literature and in all sense of self, that the machine is an other that needs to be destroyed. So Jane hides out until she can find an ally in Indul and come out and come to him and be like, hey, this is me. You're going to accept me because I know who you are, because I have omnipresent knowledge, right?
Yeah.
The other bit that leads me to it is, book actually uses the line, I am the speaker of the dead, which is the second novel in the series.
Yes.
And which is where Jane shows up.
Interesting.
So when those two moments happen, I was like, okay, we may not be taking as much as we did from Ursula K. Le Guin's short story that we did in season three, but those definitely some allusions and some nods to classic sci-fi outside of this, you know, the Trek sphere.
Which I like. That's good. That's good stuff. Yeah, and this I found it very interesting, and I love the debate. You know, like, okay, what are we going to do with Zora? What is Zora exactly? They come to a sort of classic Star Trek resolution where she lives on a technicality, right? That because she's not an AI anymore, because she's been able to alter her core programming, which apparently even an AI cannot do. So when her primary directive is to protect the ship and its crew, and Kovik is like, well, that's not your official, that's not the programming that you were originally given. And she wrote it herself. Well, so apparently, according to Star Trek, that means that she's not an AI. She's some kind of new life form they created, which sounds to me like a technicality. But Thea's raising her finger, so.
It wasn't that point that allowed for that revelation. That is the, remember, that's the turning point in that storyline.
Yeah.
That's when the danger shows up, because Stamets says, what's to prevent her from changing her mind?
Right.
And then they discover that she has, and she doesn't even know this, she has dreams.
Oh, yeah.
And the dreams are of the crew. And that's the moment that changes that story into, you are a fully realized life form.
Okay, because
and I love that it is a Trek loophole. They love the loopholes. That's how Data stays on in Measure of a Man. Like, Trek loves their, like, Volvo jiu-jitsu to get to the resolution that is the best resolution. And this is Discovery's take on that.
Yeah.
But can we rewind a little bit in this old plot line?
Yeah.
So I was really struck when Stamets comes in and he automatically does the tone the sound up.
Yeah.
And like Kovacs calls him on it. I was like, I don't have time for your games. I've seen this movie.
Yeah.
I think I directed this movie at one point.
Right.
Like, all right, let's just cut that bullshit. But I bring that up because immediately Zora, if we again take this as a trans metaphor, and it's not a one-to-one metaphor, because if it was, it would not be as interesting. But if we take the trans metaphor as literal, she creates a failsafe to destroy herself.
Yeah.
As a means of supplanting the comfort of her ally. Right?
Right.
Stamets is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Stamets doesn't know why he's uncomfortable.
Right.
And the computer doesn't want to have a fight on those terms. And right. It's like, okay, fine. I just won't use the restroom in public spaces.
Right.
Essentially, right? Like yeah. that's sort of the narrative that's happening. Except this is Star Trek, it's fiction, it's taken to the extreme of I will willingly terminate my existence so that we can continue having this conversation and you will be slightly put at ease.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And part of it is she didn't want to leave it even if she got to pick a new form. Which I found interesting that it wasn't being with the crew meant everything to her.
Yeah, the ship is her body, right? Like,
right.
This is my form. And if right. I were to be given a different form, I wouldn't be me anymore, which is very much a trans metaphor, right? Like, that's where I really feel like it's kind of goes from implicit to explicit. From a narrative standpoint, like, okay, well, let's just turn Zora into a member of the crew, give her a body, and now we've cast somebody as Zora, and the actress walks on, and she just plays Zora, and she joins the bridge crew or whatever. And from a narrative standpoint, that's a perfectly good solution to your problem, but it's not good because it violates Zora's self-determination. She's like, I don't want another body. This is my body, and I'd rather die than have a different one. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's so much to unpack with this subplot. Not yeah. even subplot, this plot.
Yeah.
We're just gonna just drop the sub in it.
Yeah, I really felt
it's totally a Dom plot.
The Zora plot is the main plot for this episode, which is weird when we think about the diplomatic thing happening in the background. But the diplomatic argument is completely contingent on what happens with Zora, because the whole point of it is we need the coordinates mm-hmm. before we can do anything with a first contact mission. So it becomes phrased as, well, we have to wait for the coordinates so we can do a first contact later, or we can blow it up now. And it becomes like short-term solution versus long-term solution. And of course, human beings think short-term, right? Like it's well established by psychology and sociology that we have a hard time prioritizing long-term goals over short-term rewards. And Tarka and Book are personifications of that, right? Now, let's talk about Tarka for a minute, because we talked about this a little bit before the show, because he's sort of confusing me. Tarka is a very ambiguous character in the show so far. Last episode, we talked about how he's kind of pegged him as a villain. He comes up with this way to blow up what he says. And let's verify something up front here. We have no way of verifying anything Tarka says. Everything he's talking about. Last episode, we had Stamets there. So it's like, okay, Tarka and Stamets are doing this thing, and Stamets is with him and he seems to understand it and he seems to be impressed by it. So there's somebody checking his math. This episode, none of that shit happens. Tarka shows up, says, I built a super weapon that will blow up the DMA. And everyone else goes like, okay. Like they just believe him. And then when he gets alone with Book, and they share scar stories. Apparently, Book also had an emerald chain scar on the back of his neck that he got rid of or something. I think that's what that was the implication that they got out of all that. And that now Tark is saying, well, this is personal for me. I'm not just trying to blow up this big machine. I'm not just trying to prove that I'm the smartest man in the galaxy. This is personal for me. I had a dear friend who was also a scientist, and Isthea's shaking her head, doesn't believe this for a hot minute. We both agreed that we were prisoners of the Emerald Chain, and we agreed that if we ever got out of here, we would reunite in another universe. And but to get to this other universe, I need the power source that's inside the DMA. So, Book, big teary eye, you'll help me, right? Like that's, so we're sort of manipulating Book by using an emotional appeal rather than Tarka's kind of narcissistic glory chasing, which is what it's kind of been for Tarka in the past. What do we think of this whole thing? Is he trying to go to another universe? If he is, what universe would it be? Book specifically said, oh, you want to go to the mirror universe? And Tarka's like, no, that's stupid. Why would I want to go there? There's plenty of other universes to go to. I'm thinking the only other universe, which we've talked about in the show, if you remember, in Discovery, is the movie universe, the Abrams universe, the Kelvin timeline, because a character from the Kelvin timeline showed up in the Discovery timeline and Kovacs talks about him as an example of this sort of cross timeline shenanigans. So is he trying to break through to the Abrams timeline, to the Kelvin verse? Is that what this is doing? I get the feeling that the two of you have different opinions. So maybe we'll start with Thea.
Oh no! Let's let Carrie.
What do you think about all of this? What is Tarka's? What is up with Tarka?
I don't know if we have differing opinions or not. I didn't necessarily buy that Tarka. Part of it didn't make sense to me. Of if he needs to borrow this technology that doesn't exist anywhere within our universe to have enough power to get to the other universe.
Yep.
How did his friend do it? And maybe it was just more symbolic of, I need to complete the journey that we talked about, so one of us gets to live the better life. But I mean, part of it was he kept relying on the fact that I need to get to see my home, my friend.
I'm very suspicious of the fact that this scientist was not named. It from a writing standpoint, it's really weird. Tarka drops plenty of names of people that we have not seen this season. Like who was the Emerald Chain scientist that he mentions at least once this episode?
That was Mitchell, I think.
Who is this scientist? Why did you not name them? It just seems weird. I don't know.
Well, if he gave him a name, Book could then research that and be like, hey. So, okay.
I agree with Carrie's point, which had not occurred to me. Like, okay, if you need this one in a billion thing to get to this other universe, how is your friend going to join you? Like, if the only way to make this thing that gets you to another universe is a huge power source that's greater in technology than anything in known space, your friend can't possibly be there. I don't know. Thea, help us out.
All right. So I think, like I said on the show, and I'm going to use profanity, he's a lying son of a bitch. And he strikes me as one of those people that goes around telling everyone how empathic they are and how they can feel everyone's emotions. And really, they're just trying to manipulate other people around them to do what it is that they want.
Okay.
And I sort of feel like this story has a ton of holes. There was the technological hole that Carrie brought up. Okay, yep. You need X amount of power. This is a once in a lifetime event that's going to happen. You know, more power than the Bourne kind of situation.
Yep.
How is this other person going to be there? Well, he mentions, oh, the guy could be dead or alive or whatever. But he doesn't talk about searching for the scientist. He just gives him enough of a narrative that plays on the fact that Book is currently struggling not only with the destruction of his planet, he's struggling with a sense of a self in terms of, like, what does it mean to be the last Kryptonian?
Yeah.
What does it mean to be the last Quajon? He's struggling with that, but he's also struggling with his romantic partner.
Yep.
So Tonka suddenly has this potentially romantic, you know, relationship or deep, meaningful connection with someone.
Yeah.
And that is the thing that's motivating him to get Book to go along, to give him the ship, to do the thing.
It's
all very convenient that this shows up at this point in the story.
We've seen Tarka be very good at manipulating people last episode. This was something that we noticed right away, that he could he can get people to do what he wants them to do. Yeah, go on.
So again, I think he's just gaslighting Book. He, like, whether or not he wants to travel to another universe, because we know that Lieutenant Commander Yule, he unspooled. Like, the JoJo plot point, which is where Lieutenant Commander Yule came from as a temporal Cold War soldier who came from the Kelvin universe, was that his molecules rejected being in a parallel universe, and that the only way JoJo could survive was through the Guardian of fucking Forever. Like the magic box that has only been seen one other time is the one thing that could save JoJo. How is this scientist going to use his power to go to a parallel universe and live the rest of his life in greener pastures? Like, there was so much that isn't explained, and there's so many holes that it sort of reminds me of, if you watch Deep Space Nine, one of the main characters is Gul Dukat.
Yep.
And if you talk to Gul Dukat, he will tell you how awesome Gul Dukat is and how loving he was and how it could have been so much worse under some other Cardassian. But he loved the Bajoran people and he did everything he could about the Bajoran people. And he lies for 6 fucking seasons. He lies to anyone and everyone. He's in prison. He has a mental break because finally his lies catch up to him. And there was one episode where he is stuck with Sisko and they're stuck on a planet, like classic Trek always does.
Yes.
The two of them have to survive. Sisko is injured. He's got a broken arm. And Dukat is finally, his demons are catching up to him. And this 45 minutes of a quote-unquote character assassination for those stands of Gul Dukat. But really, he's just finally being honest with himself. All the Cardassian veneer is gone. And he's just this man who's a cruel, petty tyrant. He's a fascist. And now he acknowledges his fascism, and he's going to sign up with the evil devils of the Bajoran religion, right?
Yeah.
I kind of feel like this is, like, we'll never get season-long villain arcs again like that, because that's not how television is structured these days.
Yeah.
Or at least that's not how Star Trek is structured with television. We're never going to get that sort of, like, long, drawn-out story. We got Tonka Hale, and Tonka is clearly in that villain role of, I'm manipulating everyone, and I'll tell you what you need to know to get whatever it is I need out of you. And then I'll just throw you aside. Like, that's what Stamets says in the episode. Tonka is introduced because he hasn't had a conversation with Tonka.
That's right.
Because at that point, Tonka didn't need to talk to Stamets.
Yeah.
But when Tonka needs to talk to Stamets, he's Stamets' best friend. They're making jokes. They got Jet Reno cracking wise in the background because that's what Tonka needed in that moment. And the moment he doesn't need them, we don't hear from him. There's an episode in between those two Tonka episodes, and we don't hear a word about him. He's mentioned in, I think, a captain's log.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
There's a moment coming where Tarka is going to leave Book out to dry, where he's going to throw Book under the bus. right? We should, and Book is going to regret every decision he has made, right? And we're going to see Tarka as the bad guy that he is. I don't know. Maybe that's just me wishful thinking.
We're going to crash land on the planet. He's going to have a broken arm. No, I don't think it's going to be that on the nose, but I sort of believe, and I think it's a really interesting choice that they went with Ryzen as the race.
Yeah.
Because it's a planet we've been to a lot. Like Enterprise, like every three episodes, they would stop by Ryza. Like,
yeah.
Keep it in your jumpsuit, Scott Bakula. Come on. it's a planet we know about, but we also don't know about it. We've only had a couple actual Ryzen episodes. Like, the first time we meet Ryza is Captain's Holiday, and that is a Ferengi episode. And a Pakal love story episode, right? Like,
yeah.
We're not delving into the culture. We are introduced to the Hogan, and that's about it. That's all we get from the culture. So we don't really quite understand or know what the Ryzens are like. And I think it's really interesting that you make them a heavy.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing I want to point out, and this may not be apropos of anything, uh-huh. but did anyone else miss Klingons in that scene? Like, the Klingons are absent.
So
they wasn't at the meeting.
The Earth representative is the same Earth representative we saw last season, who at the time was kind of wearing a Babylon 5 uniform. I remember it looked like suspiciously like Babylon 5.
Now she looks like she came from the Robin Hood episode.
Yeah.
The stewardess like, captain. Oh, yeah. She visited us. We had some shit.
But you're right. Like, are there no Klingons in Discovery's future?
I don't know if there's no Klingons, but there's no Klingons present. Like, we have Romulans, we have Vulcans. Like, my brain kept racking, like, what races are missing? Like, we see an Andorian. Like, okay, we saw a Tellarite. I'm like, all right. So we got all the founding members in some way, shape, or form.
But they haven't all joined the Federation yet. I think only the Vulcans are in the Federation.
Yeah, so they're at least in the room, but
there
was no Klingons, there was no Tholians, like there was no Gorn, like I would kill.
And theoretically, it was supposed to be everyone was, because this dealt with the entire galaxy, that everyone had a vote. That was my justification for their wacky vote.
But there's still some logistical problems, right? Because it's about dilithium. Like, the Federation is still the only source of dilithium. And so if you don't have dilithium or some other method of faster than light travel, so maybe we haven't made a successful deal with the Klingons yet and dropped off a package of dilithium for them. Like, maybe the Klingon Empire is still fractured because of the lack of warp travel, right? Like, we it's interesting. Like, what happened to the Klingons? It's a very good question. And it's one that I presume the showrunners didn't want to get into the whole Klingon thing, because we've been dealing with Klingons so much in the first season of Discovery. But
I imagine you might be right. But I also can't help but think, like, this is really where you can just rewrite the Klingons. Like, you can do anything you want with the Klingons. Like you're 1,000 years in the future. You have a Federation without Ulth and Vulcan. Like, you could do anything you want with the Klingons now.
That might actually be it. I remember, like, maybe they're saving the Return of the Klingons for its own episode. Like, we don't want to show a Klingon now because we want to make First Contact with the Klingons an episode. Like, I know this, I'm doing a weird comics deep cut that I do sometimes, so just bear with me. But when Busek and George Perez came back to Avengers, and they were doing Avengers Volume 3, right? It was right after the Heroes Reborn thing. And they do a four issue run, getting the Avengers back together again. And the villain is Morgan Le Fay. And everybody is like, why did you pick Morgan Le Fay? Like, Busek got some critique for that. And even so much so that people are like, well, it's got to be Loki. Because Loki helped create the Avengers. The villain is obviously going to be Loki. So much so that at one point in the book, Busek has the character of Crystal say, I could have sworn it was Loki, right? Like, but it's not Loki, it's Morgan Le Fay. And Busek defended his choice by saying, well, I wanted it to be about the Avengers, not about the villain. If I brought back Loki, it would be a Loki story. It would be bigger, and it would detract from the thing I actually wanted to have the attention on. I bet that's why there were no Klingons yet. I think that if they they could show us the Ferengi, because we're not going to have a whole episode about meeting the Ferengi. But I think they are saving the Klingons for something. I wouldn't want to spoil it in a cameo. Like, okay, there's just this Klingon standing here. Let's save that reveal for a bigger plot point. That's my theory.
To your point, now that you've mentioned the idea of saving it, like, you have a survival of the Battle of the Binary Stars, which was the Klingons' false introduction after Ultra's time. So there's been 100 years. So now you can be like, okay, we haven't had contact with the Klingons for 500 years. And you have Bonham front and center as the captain and a survival of that last incident and someone who has a lot of blood with the Klingons.
Yeah.
I actually like that a little bit more, but it was just, I was looking around the room going, okay, I know these guys.
Yeah, for sure.
There was no Klingon tale. There was no, the Gorn will mention the pilot of the last season.
Okay.
Because I love the arena, and whenever Gorn get mentioned, I'm like, okay, put a ping in it from my catalog of nonsense I got going on over here.
The butterfly people were there, right?
The butterfly people were there. I'm like, oh, look, Dickelson made a paycheck. Which was his name in Letterkenny. So
okay.
I was like, oh, okay, that was Dickinson. Like, I'm not even going to remember the main character's name. I'm like, this is just Dickinson.
Well, what are we looking for? We've got a few weeks break. We're gonna be watching Prodigy for a few weeks. And then Discovery will be back with the second half of its season. What would you like to see, Carrie? I'm not asking for predictions. I'm just asking what would you like to see in the show?
I mean, because I watched the trailers. I don't know if everyone. So looking ahead to the big reveal of the, what is it, C10?
10, I think it's 10C.
10C, I
think it's 10C. You know, what exactly they're composed of, but I'm also interested in, you know, can Book and Burnham find a way to come together again? Cause obviously they're setting up for a huge confrontation.
Yeah.
Next episode.
Yeah.
Where they're sent to stop, you know, we've all voted on peace and now it's going to get messed up by two guys.
Yeah. Two dudes, two straight dudes. Yeah. Thea, what about you? What do you want to get out of the rest of the season?
So I saw the trailer too, because at this time they were like, okay, we need to whet your appetite. Don't cancel your subscriptions yet, folks. Star Trek Apology is a good show.
Yeah.
Star Trek does friendships really well. Like long, drawn out, slow-burn friendships. Star Trek hasn't done that with a romance.
Okay.
Star Trek has a lot of romantic episodes. There's a lot of like done in one episodes. There's like the Picard episode where he falls in love with the crewman and she's nearly dead and he like agonizes on the bridge and like Riker has to sort of take over. Like it does like dramatic one-shot, you know, romances really well.
Yeah.
But ongoing storytelling, like the ins and outs of how a relationship works.
Yeah.
Like, I want to see a resolution to that. And maybe that's the soap opera in me, you know, the level of the X-Men. Well, I'm like, I don't care what Magneto's up to. Wild Gene and Psyche fighting. Like, I want to see a resolution to that. That is like, they don't necessarily have to be together at the end, but I sort of want to see how that goes more than I do want to see like cosmic stuff or where is the universe going to be at the end of the season. Like I'm really just sort of invested in this romance at this
point. The long-term romances that we saw were on Deep Space Nine, weren't they?
That's the closest we've gotten was Sisko's relationship to Cassidy and then Odo's sudden romantic relationship with Kira which I'm still angry about.
And like Worf. 14 years later. And Worf.
Oh, yeah, and Worf and Jadzia, but they kill off Jadzia, right?
Yeah.
Like, I have to say, we haven't mentioned it. The slow burn of the Saru and the Navarre president.
Oh, my favorite bit of the entire episode.
Right, exactly.
How did we miss it?
When you brought up the romances, it occurred to me that I'm loving that ongoing storyline.
I just want to bring out what the reason why I find that particular ongoing relationship to be so noteworthy is because Saru is the only straight white dude in the main cast, and he's an alien. Right? Like his ongoing relationship with the president of Navarre, Tarina.
Yep.
Yeah. Is the white heterosexual relationship on this show. And the fact that they're both aliens, I just find hilarious. And I think it's great. And they're, you know, a romantic relationship between two people that are so subdued and unemotional about anything, and it just cracks me up. And it's super, it's cute, it's sweet, it's just so sincere
and every time they cut back to it, and I love it, and I'm so happy. Yeah. I'm just like, okay, I really don't want Jason to be right. I really hope that this is not like Saru's Mr. Spock thing, and that's going to be the resolution. Because you had a role in the RPGs that we played where if, like, you have three romances going on, right, one has to start a romance, one has to be the steady romance, and one romance has to fall apart.
That's right.
Because that's sort of like you got the wish fulfillment going on with the relationship that's working. You got the excitement and the joy de vivre of a relationship that's beginning. And then you got like the existential dread of a relationship ending. I think we'll see in that rotation here on this show.
That's stolen from Hill Street Blues, right? Like the old cop show that was really pioneered this idea of season long plots, right? Like every episode of Hill Street Blues would be a cop show, but there were ongoing relationship plots that would go throughout an entire season, and that's where that comes from. I had a theory at the beginning of this season. That it's heavily based on Wrath of Khan, to the extent that if Burnham is Kirk and Book is Kirk's McCoy, that Saru is Burnham's Spock, and that means Saru's going to have to sacrifice himself at the end of the season to save everyone. And the fact that they're giving Saru a romance just to make that death harder at the end.
Romance with a Vulcan.
With a Vulcan.
Like the one person who's going to understand what that sacrifice means, because it's so embedded in the identity that we have of Vulcans. Because Spock says it all the time. Like Spock stubs his toe and he tells the other nine toes, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of you, big toe. Like,
all right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. We're going to wrap it up with the needs of the many and the stubbed toe metaphor, which has got to be that's a show topper. So we're going to leave it there. But we will be, so we're going to take a break for a few weeks. Discovery comes back in February and we will also be back then. In the meantime, Thea's right. Watch Prodigy. It's a great show. And thanks, Carrie. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You've been a longtime fan of the show and dear friends of both myself and Thea for a very long time. So it's delightful to have you on. And we're going to, in the second half of the season, we're just going to cycle through all of our guests over again.
So it's really easy booking.
Yeah, you might be here for the end of the season. You might be in the season finale if we keep the same order. So
we should do it inversely. So Carrie should be the first co-host back.
Okay.
We should just go in reverse order.
Okay.
And make them look like geniuses.
Okay. All right. So you might be back sooner than you think.
Fair enough.
Thanks, everyone. See you next time.
Bye.